Good morning, and welcome to our final plenary. Oh, I'm a little sad. Hopefully, all of you were able to enjoy our reception last night, which was great. It was at Xavier Library, and we had a really wonderful time. So hopefully, you were able to join in on that. But we'll get started. So as our time in New Orleans draws to a close, we'd like to thank you for joining us here. And we hope that you found the sessions to be inspiring and invigorating. And really, I hope it's kind of like a call to action, that when you leave here, you just won't leave all the things that you've done here, but you'll actually go and act on some of the things that we talked about and all the great things that your colleagues presented. But I want to acknowledge some folks that were critical in making this conference happen. So please stand when I say your name or your committee, and we invite you all to just join us in giving them a round of applause at the end as well. Alfred Lemon and the Local Arrangements Committee and volunteers. Conference Program Planning Committee, including panel session chair Greg Schmidt. Elizabeth Cruces, who was the posters chair. Participant-driven sessions chair, Diane Diaz-DeFazio. Promotions Committee Chair, E.C. Schroeder. Who was also, along with Elizabeth Jofrian, the Local Arrangements Liaison. Leah Richardson in the Seminars Committee. Christina Kassman and Elizabeth Wilkinson and the Workshops Committee. Jay Silvestri and the Website Development Team. Timothy Johnson and the Scholarships Committee. Charlotte Priddle, Kim Tully, and the Membership and Professional Development Committee. Recorder Kate Hutchins and the Publications and Communication Committee. Everyone at the Astor Crown Plaza and here in New Orleans who showed us a great hospitality. And last, but certainly not least, and very dear to my heart, she got me through this whole process, RBMS Section Chair, Athena Jackson. So please, if you see them, thank them for their hard work too. A lot of people have been coming up to me, but this can't happen with just one person. It takes a whole team to make this happen. And I wanted to say a special thank you to last month, my father died during the process of this, and so it's a lot of details, and it was during the time where all the details have to come together. And I remember I sent Athena a text and said, my daddy is gone, but I'm okay. And she responded, don't worry about RBMS. And I told the rest of the committee as well, and essentially they said the same thing, don't worry about RBMS now. And they filled in all the blanks. And sorry. Thank you. And when I was dropping balls, they picked them up. And so I'm really, really grateful. Thank you so much.
Real quick, Tori, are you here? There she is. Okay, so I just have to say that sometimes she isn't here when this happens because she's always busy. There's this human being called Tori Andrela that you may know and might have received emails from, and I think it goes without saying that Tori also has helped us with such graciousness and kindness and patience and willingness to try something new and different, and I know you continue to do that with RBMS as we push your boundaries, as we extend ours, and we're really glad for that. So, and a token of Petrina and my appreciation, I'd like for you to come to get this gift so we can all give you a round of applause. By the way, this bag was... Kate and Ben, this bag is the bag from the restaurant, from the place I bought it. This is reusable paper. It's from a present. I didn't buy anything to make this gift, but everything in it is new.
So, the programming wouldn't be possible without the many speakers and moderators who shared their time and experiences with us throughout the program. Thank you for a wonderful series of presentations and sharing your expertise with us these last few days for all the ones who remain. We'd like to extend a special thank you to Bonhams for sponsoring our closing plenary session. We're grateful for your support. Before we turn to our speakers for what promises to be an excellent final plenary session, I'd like to invite next year's conference co-chairs to tell you a little bit about the RBMS program at the annual meeting and the exciting conference that they have planned for us next year.
So I know we all applauded for Petrina, but I don't know if we actually got to thank her for her role on this year's. So can I just say that? Can I say thank you, Petrina? So this, from my perspective, was a really good conference, and we have a tough act to follow. But we're really excited to take RBMS 2019 to Baltimore next year. It's going to be held June 18th through the 21st. So you may have seen the CFP already, but the Archives and Special Collections Library Communities, as part of our global community, face prospective major shifts in our energy systems, our economic models, and literal landscapes. Current and predicted impacts associated with climate change offer highly varied and unpredictable futures for our collections, our collecting, our facilities, services, funding, our users, our communities, and our professional lives. So the title of the 2019 conference is going to be Response and Responsibility. Kate came up with that Jane Austen-esque title. Special Collections and Climate Change. And we look forward to engaging our attendees and the broader Archives and Special Collections communities in a candid and forward-looking, and at times probably challenging, conversation about our work in the era of climate change. And we eagerly look forward to building on the conversation that we will begin today with today's final plenary, and we can attest that the programming we will speak to everyone here. We really hope to give everyone, librarians, archivists, book dealers, all of us who care about the future of history, space to explore these profound implications and practical insights to take home. So we should also do some housekeeping. Next year, or new this year, the Conference Planning Committee has streamlined the proposal submission process. A unified submission form is now out there on the web for you to use. And please note that our deadline for submission is August 3rd. Thank you. I'll turn it over to Kate.
So, and if you're going to ALA Annual, which is right here in New Orleans, you don't have to go so far, no bus this time. Please join us all for the RBMS, I think it's called a forum now, the forum program, entitled Documenting and Raising Awareness of the Effects of Climate Change. It takes place on Sunday, June 24th at the Grand Chanier Room, Sheraton, New Orleans, from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. Did I say Sunday? It's on Sunday. This program will examine the unique roles and responsibilities of special collections libraries and archives in an era of sea level rise and climate change. Our speakers include environmental justice activist, organizer, and artist Judith Nieto from Another Gulf is Possible, Dr. Heather Stone, University of Louisiana Lafayette, who will speak about her work to gather oral histories of tribal and other residents on Ile de Jean Charles, y'all are really testing my French here, in Terrebonne Parish, and Jennifer Waxman of the Alliance for Response in New Orleans. And we hope to see you all there. And now we turn it back over to Petrina.
Thank you, Kate and Ben. So now please welcome to the stage our moderator for this session, Diane Diaz-DeFazio. She is public services librarian at the Irma and Paul Milstein Division of United States History, Local History, and Genealogy at the New York Public Library, where she specializes in architectural history, New York City, and genealogical research using maps and photography. She received her master's in library and information science from Pratt Institute and holds a master's in historic preservation from Columbia University. She is a founder and creative director of at IG Libraries, an international group celebrating the bibliophile community through social media. Please join me in welcoming Diane.
Hi, everybody. While I adjust the slides for a second. Thank you, Petrina. Good morning. Bienvenidos and bienvenue à la pleine toi. Sorry about all that French, Kate. my name is Diane Diaz-DeFazio, and it is my great honor to serve as moderator for the closing session of the 2018 RBMS conference. Thank you to Bonhams and to RBMS Vice Chair Petrina Jackson, and to conference chair, Athena Jackson, and conference chair, Petrina Jackson, for your confidence and support. And to my fellow committee members and subcommittee members, and thank you. To my friends, to Tony and the first Diane for their guidance and encouragement. And can we all just take a moment to thank the tech staff here. Harris, Drew, Chase, and Stan, led by Kwame, are helping us out. So they need a round of applause. Thank you, Kwame. So, thank you all very much for coming this morning. Let's go. What has happened down here is the wind has changed. In 1819, writing in his journal, after a few days' voyage up the Mississippi from the Baileys and past the Plaquemines, Benjamin Henry Latrobe wrote, "New Orleans has, at first sight, a handsome and very imposing appearance. Beyond any other city in the United States in which I have yet been, it was impossible not to stare at a sight wholly new, even to one who has traveled much in Europe and America. Now, nearly 100 years later, we converged on this crescent city. Like the rivers that flow from far-flung tributaries down to the great water, over the last few days, we explored New Orleans tastes, heeded the spirits of Marie Laveau and Père Antoine. walk through the ancestral land of the Huma and the Chirimaca, from the Garden District to the Cabildo. And we heard the music of Lafcadio Hearn, William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams, Bessie Smith, and Cheeky Black. We discussed, participated, laughed with, and learned from each other in this city that care forgot. Ecologists might liken us to, with our annual conferences, that is, a disturbance regime, a temporary environmental change that profoundly affects an ecosystem thenceforth. This plenary is titled Environment, and we will reflect on our responsibilities as cultural heritage institutions to protect our facilities, collections, and the voices of our communities. We will explore the multifaceted impact of meteorological convergences, environmental calamities, and take a look at historical evidence of disasters' potential to erase cultural legacies. Elmore Leonard advised writers, never open a book with weather. So we took his advice, and we conclude with it. I'm joined this morning by Dr. Matthew Mulcahy and Brian Paris. After my introduction, they will each present, and we'll conclude with a Q&A before Athena brings us home and wraps things up. Our speakers are documenters of climate change, past and present, and each in his own way engages the next generation to be empowered as community historians and defenders of the stories who might easily be left off the archival record. Dr. Matthew Mulcahy is professor and chair of history at Loyola University of Maryland. His first book, Hurricanes and Society in the British Greater Caribbean, 1624 to 1783, examined how British colonists made sense of new and terrifying storms they encountered when they settled in places like South Carolina, Jamaica, and Barbados. It provided perspective on colonial science, the plantation economy, slavery, and public and private charity. In Hubs of Empire, the Southeastern Lowcountry and British Caribbean, Mulcahy argues that it is useful to view Barbados, Jamaica, and the British Leeward Islands, along with the South Carolina and Georgia Lowcountry, as a single region, separated by thousands of miles of ocean, but united by a shared history and economic interest. He regularly teaches a course called Disasters in American History that examines past disasters from the colonial period until today and has students investigate newspaper and other primary resources to analyze a single calamity and its consequences. Dr. Mulcahy graduated from McAllister College and received his PhD from the University of Minnesota. He is currently working on broad surveys of hurricanes, earthquakes, drought, and insect infestations in the early modern Caribbean. We're joined by Brian Paris, a Houston filmmaker, who maybe you met last night, who specializes in documentation of environmental and social justice movement stories, as organizer, media coordinator, and founder of TEJAS, Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services. Mr. Paris has recently worked on location, chronicling events in Greater New Orleans and rural Louisiana after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, environmental justice and immigrants' rights actions in Houston's Manchester neighborhood and Taylor, Texas, and the huge groundswell of support for unjustly incarcerated African-American youth in Gina, Louisiana. Mr. Paris is a Theater of the Oppressed practitioner and has collaborated with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, Center in Environmental Toxicology at the University of Texas Medical Branch Galveston on an environmental health risk survey of storm impact zones in Louisiana, producing a DVD entitled After the Wind Child, After the Water's Gone, a project also documented in the Journal of Healthcare for the Poor and Underserved in an article entitled Hurricane Readiness, Environmental Risks on the Bayous, an NIEHS community-based pilot project in South Terrebonne LaForge Parishes, Louisiana, which he co-authored. Brian holds a BS in psychology from the University of Texas at Austin. He co-produces a weekly radio program, Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say, for Pacific Network Station KPFT.
He has presented with John Sullivan at numerous EPA community involvement conferences, the Alaska Environmental Forum, and the Pedagogy and Theater of the Oppressed annual conference. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Assistance with slides here. I'm intrigued by the Elmore Leonard quote. There's a famous history of the South that was published in the early 20th century. New Orleans presentation. Okay. Which actually starts, "Let us begin with the weather." That's the opening line of the book. So I need to somehow contrast that with the Elmore Leonard quote. I have to get that. You want to go to slideshow? I'll also apologize in advance. I need a new prescription for my glasses, which I just went to get last week, but I'm definitely going down on my nose as I'm reading here. So I wish I had done it a week or so earlier.
Hold on.
Voila. Excellent. Thank you. Thanks very much. Let me start by saying thanks very much to the planning group for inviting me to participate today, to Petrina, to Athena, to Diane, and to others who I don't know, and especially to Jay Silvestri. Jay is a former student of mine, and I'm really flattered that he remembered a course that he took with me on disasters in American history at least 13 years ago, which suggests we're both getting rather old here. But I was very excited to hear that he was involved in this, and I really am grateful to have an opportunity to speak with you today. Let me also say I'm really grateful to be here today as well to say a kind of thanks in person for all of the work that you do. As a historian, it's really been my great privilege to spend time in a number of your archives and special collections. Working at places like the James Ford Bell Library at the University of Minnesota, the John Carter Brown Library, the Huntington, are they out there? The Library of the American Philosophical Society, other places. I've been remarkably fortunate to have benefited from the expertise of the librarians and archivists on staff there over the years. So a collective thank you to all of you for the work that you do for historians, for me and for other historians. I actually briefly attended the session before this and was saying to some people that I'm honored to be here, but one of the things that was apparent in listening to the panel was that we have to figure out a way to get some of you folks to our conferences, because I think that would be a really a great conversation to have more archivists and librarians at the American Historical Association or the American History Conference, et cetera. So, Okay, let me move on here. So I want to organize my remarks today around the stories we tell about natural disasters and the stories that have not been told about them. That my research is on natural disasters in the early modern period. And more specifically, I'd like to talk a little bit about how people have talked about why disasters happen, about their causes, both in the past and today. And then second, I want to consider briefly the issue of archival source materials and the stories that have been told and not told about one disaster in particular, the 1927 Mississippi River flood. To start, as you are all well aware, it's been a bad year or so for disasters, particularly here in the United States. Hurricanes in Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico last summer, and we're about to enter hurricane season again here, right? Wildfires in California, ongoing drought in many parts of the West, terrible flooding near where I live in Baltimore just this past month. All have served as jarring reminders of the power of natural forces to damage property, to disrupt affairs, and to threaten the lives of individuals and even whole communities. In all of these cases, I think it's important for us that we're reminded of a key point, and maybe an obvious point, but one worth stating again and again, I think, is that natural disasters are never simply natural events. Whether we consider the issue of urban sprawl and the loss of wetlands in the Houston metropolitan area, or the longstanding economic crisis in Puerto Rico and its ongoing neo-colonial political status, we are reminded that the impact of any disaster is determined by pre-existing social, political, economic, cultural, and physical conditions and relationships, and by decisions made by human beings before, sometimes long before, during and after the event itself. Natural hazards, hurricanes, earthquakes, lack of rain, only become disasters when they impact and affect human communities. And those communities shape the impact of disasters in fundamental ways for better or worse. I think the key point. Moreover, as has become increasingly clear in the past few decades, human actions are intensifying the power and scope of natural hazards. Whether we consider the role of global warming and rising sea surface temperatures in fueling ever more powerful hurricanes, or whether we think about a warmer atmosphere that can hold more moisture and thus produce more intense rainfall and flooding, or conversely, a heightened evaporation and lead to more intense drought conditions, it's clear that the relationship between human actions and natural forces is increasingly blurry. Such issues may appear particularly modern, but what I want to suggest briefly here this morning is that they are really an updated version of a discourse that dates back at least to the beginnings of European colonization of the Americas in the early modern period. The word disaster is derived from the Greek by way of the Old French and Italian, meaning ill or bad star, and it reflects the ancient belief in the power of the heavens to shape events on Earth. The word retained that meaning in early modern Europe as well, but for most Europeans and most European colonists who would come to the Americas, hurricanes, hurricanes which were an entirely new phenomena for Europeans, earthquakes, great fires, and the like, were providences, supernatural events, acts of God sent to punish wayward humans or to warn them of a worse fate to come if they did not reform their ways. The cause of natural disasters in the early modern period was quite simple, sin, right? The, quote, evil ways of an offending people, right, had resulted in some calamity or another. Europeans believed this, so too did Native Americans and enslaved Africans and African Americans. They all viewed disasters in a similar framework. For all these people, disasters were divine events, although I will say they had different ideas about which gods were involved and to whom they were speaking, but they were all divine events, right? Stories about disasters, the stories that people told, started to change in the middle of the 18th century. The increased interest in natural philosophy, and I'll just, let me page down here. This is probably the earliest known woodcut of a hurricane. It dates from 1638, from the Caribbean, from the British Caribbean. Stories about disasters started to change, and by the way, here we go, too. Sorry, I'm late, I'm slow in my slides here, but examples of kind of the idea of providential discourse around disasters. You started to change by the middle of the 18th century. The increased interest in natural philosophy, what we now call science, and investigations of the natural world that emerged during the Enlightenment called greater attention to the natural forces at work in storms and earthquakes. Such explanations did not displace divine power, but rather than seeing disasters as coming directly from the hand of God, European colonists and others talked about God's general providence, quote, the systems that he put in place, he or she put in place, that allowed storms to develop or for the earth to shake. Rather than simply trembling in fear, although they still did that, ministers and others insisted that colonists should respond to disasters with a sense of awe at God's creation. By the second half of the 19th century, ongoing scientific discoveries and increasing secularism altered the balance between science and religion even further. Disasters remained acts of God, but only in a rhetorical sense. Indeed, those who failed to make the shift were deemed irrational, unscientific, quote-unquote uncivilized, right? Instead of divine power, people increasingly talked about the phrase, quote, natural disasters, a phrase that really becomes relatively widespread by the 1880s moving onward. As an article in The Nation explained in the wake of a 1908 earthquake, quote, few persons speak of the hand of God, many of the inexorable laws of nature. The difference indicates, we think, a change in our attitudes towards the universe. Thus, instead of pointing to their own sins, Americans conceived of disasters as caused by larger natural forces beyond human control and divorced from human affairs. In doing so, however, and I think this is a key point, one historian has noted that Americans engaged in a, quote, great exercise in moral hand-washing. Disasters were tragic events, but they were not outside of our concerns. There wasn't much that anyone can do about it. That attitude, I think, dominated the discourse about natural disasters for much of the 20th century, and I don't think it's disappeared entirely. even when people recognized some role for human affairs in a disaster, something like the 1927 Mississippi River flood, the dominant discourse continued to characterize most disasters as disconnected from human affairs and actions. But that attitude has begun to shift yet again in recent decades as we've become increasingly aware of that disasters are never simply natural events and that human activity shaped their impact. A key turning point, I think, and this is somewhat impressionistic, was Hurricane Katrina. It's not that it totally doesn't exist before this, but I think it spreads more widely during Katrina. Katrina laid bare the racial and economic inequities that marked New Orleans and American society more generally and that shaped the impact and response to that disaster. And I think you saw greater attention to the natural forces that were giving rise to this disaster in the wake of it. In this sense, I'd like to suggest that we have come full circle back to the 16th or 17th century. Our sins may be different, but in recognizing a link between human action and natural disasters, we are increasingly finding ourselves in the company of our colonial forebears. What Shakespeare wrote 400 years ago remains true today. The fault is not in our stars, but in ourselves, often when we think about disasters. Let me now shift and talk briefly, again, the stuff that came out of Katrina, to talk a little bit about that sense, that shift in the conversation. Let me now shift and talk briefly about another set of stories, those that we tell about what happened in past disasters, how people experienced and survived these events, and the sources that historians use to tell those stories. And to do so, I want to focus on the 1927 Mississippi River flood, arguably the greatest flood and certainly one of the worst disasters in American history. The spring of 1926 and 1927 was exceptionally wet across much of the United States, particularly the central United States. It rained and rained and then rained some more. Rivers, including the Ohio, the Illinois, the Arkansas, the Missouri, swelled with rains. All of these rivers, as you can see from the map, poured into the Mississippi on their journey south to the Gulf. And in the spring of 1927, so much water filled the Mississippi basin that the Ohio River actually ran backwards for several days in April of that year. And it continued to rain. On April 15th, Good Friday, between 6 and 15 inches of rain fell across a vast swath of land from Texas to Alabama, from Louisiana north to Illinois. 15 inches of rain fell here in New Orleans in the span of 18 hours and put the city under 4 feet of water. Of course, because so much of the city is at or below sea level, all of this had to be pumped up over the levees, either into the swollen Mississippi or into Lake Pontchartrain. And the massive volume of water moving down the Mississippi towards the city threatened even greater damage. As is the case in all natural disasters, nature, in this case rain, was not the only factor at work in the Great Flood of 27. Beginning in the 1870s, the federal government had adopted a policy of managing the Mississippi by building extensive levees, and only building levees, rather than combining levees with outlets, spillways, reservoirs, and other flood control techniques. Not everyone agreed with this. The levee-only policy represented the political triumph of one way of managing the river over some others. I don't have time to go into all the details of this struggle between Andrew Humphreys and James Buchanan Eads. For those of you who are interested, I would direct you to John Barry's magisterial book, Rising Tide, which is really a terrific study of this. The key point is that human beings decided to implement a levees-only policy, the consequences of which were to push the river ever higher. Eventually, the water either grew too high, spilling over the levees, or levees started to collapse under the pressure, as happened in April 16th below Cairo, Illinois, on April 21st at Mounds View Landing in Mississippi. And because so much water had built up, this, when these breaks occur, it literally just kind of exploded across the countryside. Okay. Despite such breaches, the river continued to swell and roar on its path to New Orleans, threatening to overwhelm the city. To prevent that from happening, local officials and power brokers, the latter outside of formal electoral politics but yielding great power nonetheless, ordered that a levee below the city be dynamited. On April 29th, 1927, workers dynamited the levee in Plaquemines Parish, flooding much of that parish and neighboring St. Bernard's and destroying the lives and livelihoods of thousands of individuals in order to, quote, save New Orleans. New Orleans elites promised, and this just gives you a slide showing you where the levee break was below the city and the flooded area. New Orleans officials and elites had promised to compensate for the losses, but when the time came to pay, they balked. Most victims saw only pennies on the dollar. Claims were put in at about $35 million. Only about $3.8 was ever paid out, and a good chunk of that went to relatively large corporations and railroads. Average individuals living in this area got about $234 for their entire property cost. Okay. The scale of the damage across the Mississippi Basin was staggering. Water covered 27,000 square miles, roughly the size of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, and New Hampshire combined, in some areas to a depth of 30 feet. Some 931,000 people lived in this area. 600,000 were left homeless. Hundreds of thousands lived for months in tent cities. Conditions in these cities were especially bleak. This gives you a sense of the flooded area, excuse me. Conditions in these tent cities along the levees were especially bleak, and especially for African Americans, who were often guarded at gunpoint in what were essentially prison camps and forced to labor in order to receive any relief supplies. Not surprisingly, when the water receded, many packed up what they owned and fled the Delta. Over 800,000 African Americans left the Deep South in the 1920s. In some parts of the Mississippi River Delta, 50% of the African American population left between 1927 and 1928. Many headed to cities in the north, Chicago, St. Paul, New York. Others headed west to places like Houston. Not all were victims of the flood, but tens of thousands were. The story of the flood, of the massive relief efforts overseen by Herbert Hoover, and its consequences, including helping to propel Hoover to the White House and Huey Long into power in Louisiana, have all been well told, and often been well told in books by John Barry, Susan Scott Parrish, Pete Daniels, and others. So too, the story of the flood's impact on African American communities and the Great Migration is well known. But as Richard Mizell has notes in a recent book that he published just a few years ago called Backwater Blues, while we have lots of letters, diaries, official papers, and other sources from white survivors, we have virtually no such materials or interviews from black survivors to talk about their experiences during the flood. What Mizell has called the Disaster Archive for the 27 Flood and others reflects generally the experience of only a small group of individuals, usually white, wealthy, male. Moreover, he argues that for many reasons, such traditional archives obscure as much as they reveal about the black social realities during the 1927 flood. Mizell suggests that scholars need to think more creatively about the sources they use in order to get at those experiences. In his case, he turns to blues music, songs by Bessie Smith, Lizzie Douglas, Joe McCoy, as well as the short stories of Richard Wright to help piece together the African-American experience during the flood. And Mizell's book got me thinking a little bit about what constitutes a disaster archive and what materials are in a disaster archive. And it strikes me there's two kind of key issues to highlight here. One, of course, is that large-scale disasters threaten archives, right? And this has happened in the past and caused problems for people in the past. When I was doing work on the hurricanes in the Leeward Islands, I often ran across accounts such as the one by the governor of the Leeward Islands in 1676, who told his London officials, "I can't tell you anything about the economic and demographic conditions on the island because all the records are gone. They were wiped out in a hurricane 2 years earlier." Indeed, in 1676, the governments of Nevis and St. Kitts actually ordered money for a, quote, good substantial sessions house to hold government records, an early archive, as well as the construction of, quote, strong chests to secure all things paperwork during hurricane time. And this obviously remains a challenge for, today for libraries and institutions. 5 minutes? Yeah, okay, good, I'm good. Let me make sure I give proper credit here. Jeffrey Frank's study of the impact of Katrina on libraries revealed that 42 public libraries in Louisiana were either totally destroyed or severely damaged during that hurricane and flooding. Numerous others suffered significant damage, right? Private libraries also suffered great damage. Tulane's Memorial Library had 8 feet of water in its basement, destroying some 700,000 print volumes and recordings. So issues in the past, issues today. This also, of course, creates problems for future historians like me who seek to retell the story of past disasters. Indeed, much of the material that I found about hurricanes in places like Jamaica and Barbados was not in Jamaica and Barbados. It was in London and Edinburgh and Philadelphia and Boston, where those records were relatively safe from the climatic threats in the Caribbean, right? And I gather this is the topic for the session next year in Baltimore, I gather, to some extent. I offer no solutions to this issue other than to note that it's an issue that has a long history. How do we secure records in these kind of vulnerable places? But this got me thinking about the second larger issue highlighted in Mizell's book, and in other works such as Marissa Fuentes, who I gather you heard from yesterday or two days ago, her work on the study of slaves in 18th century Barbados. Not just the loss of existing material, but the absence of materials and sources, particularly from individuals and groups for whose voices have been marginalized or silenced in the past. Women, people of color, the poor. Their stories of disasters are often the stories that have not been told, and historians like myself included here, need to do a better job of thinking about how to do that, about how to work with the sources we do have, and consider what those sources might yield if we look at them through a slightly different angle, or from a different lens, from a different perspective. Mizell, Fuentes, and others have started to show us how to write a, quote, history about what an archive does not offer, using Fuentes' words. But equally important, we need to make sure that we do not allow historical silences to continue now and in the future. We need to be mindful of the stories that will not be told if we historians, anthropologists, sociologists, other academics, archivists as well, do not actively seek out a diverse range of individuals and groups. What I just read about in the New York Times is kind of rapid response collecting, right? If we don't listen to their stories about disasters and gather their materials, if we don't document and preserve their experiences with Maria, Harvey, and storms yet unnamed, and finally, if we don't make sure that those stories are widely accessible in the future. I think we're clearly moving in that direction, and again, you all know far more about this than I do. A quick internet search for Katrina reveals dozens of different oral history projects. The Historic New Orleans collection here has 500 interviews with first responders. The Lower Ninth Ward Living Museum has interviewed 60 or so people from that neighborhood about their experiences. The library at Middle Tennessee State University has interviews with people who relocated to Tennessee during the storm, right? Such materials are going to be essential for future historians to write the history of Katrina. But it's also worth noting, even as we kind of celebrate that work that's been done, that a number of even relatively recent events have a relatively small archival trail. Hurricane Betsy, which hit New Orleans in 1965 and was the last big storm to hit prior to Katrina, my quick internet search revealed a relatively few records about that storm. There are 5 interviews in LSU's library. No doubt there are more that I missed, but the difference was somewhat striking. And again, that's a relatively recent event. Moreover, a number of the links that I found for Katrina on the web no longer worked, and I was not always sure why. Which is a small reminder, again, as you well know, that while the web offers terrific opportunities for archiving and disseminating information, the web is also ephemeral, especially if sites are not curated by institutions and professionals like yourselves. Stuff can disappear quickly, right? Going forward, then, I think this is really essential work that all of us, and particularly academics, have to do, to make sure that we seek out diverse voices, to preserve those voices, and to make sure we make them accessible to future scholars, to activists like Brian, and to anyone who wants to know more about past disasters, what lessons have been learned, and what lessons have not been learned from those events. I think only then, only if we do that, can the past really serve to enlighten us fully as we confront the new challenges posed by disasters today and in the future. And with that, let me turn it over to Brian.
I'm going to make a quick little announcement as we transition our tech. If you could all remain in your seats. I know. We're going to bring the lights down in a second while Brian sets up. All right. So this is how you
close your eyes. Yeah, close your eyes, folks. You'll be all right. We'll protect you. Lock the doors in the back, y'all. Sessions is coming to get us. I just wanted to give you a sense of what the storm felt like. So, yeah, take it in. Take it in for about 15, 20 seconds. Just imagine you're in a disaster. I want to recognize that we're on Chitimacha land, Boma land. Dozens of unknown, unrecognized indigenous tribes.
When it rains 5 days in the sky, sun dark at night. When it rains 5 days in the sky, sun dark at night. Then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. I woke up this morning, can't even get out of my pillow. I woke up this morning, can't even get out of my pillow. There's enough trouble to make a poor girl wonder where she wanna go. Then they roll a little boat about 5 miles across the pond. Then they roll a little boat about 5 miles across the pond.
Okay.
I packed all my clothes, sold them in, and they rolled me along.
So this is actual footage of second day of Hurricane Harvey. And me and my father drove around just to keep an eye on what was happening. In my neighborhood, it wasn't flooding as much as it was in other parts of the city. And the really bad pouring rain hadn't hit yet. But what we did notice was a lot of emissions coming from the petrochemical and refineries and industrial sites that surround us. And when I think about how I got into this work and the theme and the topic of the conference, I try to remember, you know, that we all come to this space for different reasons and purposes. And for me, it was because our story was not being told. And no one believed us when we told it ourselves, too. And so it was important for me to begin to document some of the things that were happening. And visuals were way more impactful than just talking about it. So around 2000, when I came back from college, I was lucky enough that, you know, the times had changed so that media was becoming more present, available, affordable, and also distribution streams were also available. The internet, you know, it's something to remember that, you know, this easy access to media wasn't always available. So, you know, over the years, I've done a lot of things
alarm
like this.
Off. There have been some tornado warnings for the area, and a couple of trees down here in Eastwood.
Just simple little reports, you know, what's happening, what's going on, and trying to engage with other folks in the neighborhood. You know, one of the things that really concerned me was the smells that were in my neighborhood and in my home. You know, I'm about 2.5 miles away from the Houston Ship Channel, and it was so intense. You know, I was having headaches, feeling nauseous, a little dizzy. I told one reporter it was like punch drunk Harvey. You know, it really felt like a hangover. And I recognize all of those symptoms and feelings from having grown up here. I know what it is. And I know where it comes from. And I can name the facilities, you know, that it comes from. And so, you know, just doing this and learning how to do this became my way of sort of contributing to the environmental justice work that many elders had been doing in other ways, you know, in more academic ways, through papers, publications, reports, and so on. What I found was that regular folks often don't have access, you know, to that information. We don't even know it exists or where to get it. So thinking of special collections and archives, you know, that's even more difficult to find. And oftentimes, you know, it's away from the communities that could really benefit from having access to it. And even then, you know, there are other issues that I can talk about a little bit later. But that's, you know, what I do. I brought some gear over there that I use, you know, simple little tripod, light, microphone, and my phone now. And I carry that around with me most of the time because we never know when something is going to happen. And, you know, we get called and text and, you know, through all the different medias that we're on, we get alerted to things that are happening. And, you know, that's just another important thing, I think, for folks to remember is that, you know, many of the communities that we're talking about, the most vulnerable communities to climate change, are already vulnerable in other ways and live in states of constant stress. You know, they become normalized to all of the stressors that exist around them. So I showed you just a few of them, you know, the environmental stressors that exist day in and day out. Those flaring events, you know, they happen pretty regularly. And they also happen more regularly when there's a storm. Because for whatever reason, you know, they have not implemented safety measures to deal with power outages. They have no backup generators, or they often fail. And there's a lot of other technical stuff, you know, that we can talk about. But they've still not, you know, made their facilities safe. And they certainly are becoming more vulnerable because of the storms. So after the storm, you know, Democracy Now! Gave me a call. And I was on that Monday, and I reported on, you know, the smells and the reports that we were getting from different neighborhoods. And, you know, eventually we found out that there were some massive leaks and spills. And I think most of y'all probably saw the Arkema plant explode because they were unprepared for all this water. And, you know, oftentimes even first responders are put in harm's way, not to mention the employees at these facilities and then the communities that live around them. So, you know, that's kind of been my perspective and my take and my purpose. I was fortunate enough to also be part of another organization called Nuestra Palabra. And, you know, I feel like that's important to mention, too, because not only is no one listening to us or is no one documenting our stories, but they haven't been doing that since the beginning, right? And so, you know, it's even more difficult to start when there's no context or there's no examples or there's no, you know, people to look up to and elders, you know, or ways of discussing these things on paper and editorials and so on. And we know that, you know, a lot of our cultures stem from more oral communication approaches. That's why I do theater, and I prefer to talk than, you know, showing a slideshow. But, But I got started, you know, basically because of a school that was being built in my neighborhood. And my dad, you know, brought this to the attention of the city. He was working for Texas Southern University at the time. And I had just come back from college and decided to, you know, to help. I was teaching, and I was also noticing a lot of other problems within the community, included health, food, access to food, police brutality or criminalization of our communities for different reasons, different statuses that made it difficult for people, you know, to access help. And, you know, it led us into looking at the larger community, because what the politicians told us when they were building this school was, you know, we recognize there are some issues with this location. But if we move this school because of those reasons, you know, the kids still live there anyway. Like, so we can't, you know, move them too. It's like, so we might as well just, you know, leave them there. And, you know, it was true. It's like, yeah, they live there. There are other schools that are already present, but you're building a new one. We've got so much more information now about the health impacts of these toxics, you know. And then they said, well, where are those? You know, show me the data. How do we even know that this is, you know, a place with poor air quality? So yet again, we have to do our own sort of archival work and data gathering. So we partnered with universities that helped us, you know, do that. And we continued to pressure newspapers. And eventually the Houston Chronicle did a report called In Harm's Way that, you know, really showed that there were high levels of 1,3-butadiene and benzene right here where the school is and in the neighborhood that the folks live in, which is predominantly Latino, indigenous, and low income. And so, you know, it was true. It's like, you know, we need to not build this school here, and we need to not have communities live here also. And that was too big for them to consider or even think. But here, you know, it's just an image of the city of, and this is a little neighborhood of Manchester, and it's, you know, completely surrounded. It's kind of hard to see with the colors here, but, you know, it's surrounded by Valero Refinery, LyondellBasell Refinery, wastewater treatment plant, a fertilizer plant similar to the one that exploded in West Texas. This one's larger, a major freeway, a huge rail yard carrying, you know, the bomb trains that have exploded all over the country in the past several years, and so, you know, it sort of led us to think about space and the environment and planning, and, you know, all of this sort of led up to Hurricane Katrina, and that really changed everything, I think, for a lot of us, because all of these other overlapping issues, you know, came to a head. And it was, you know, just something that made us realize, you know, what we thought about, you know, the potential vulnerabilities of a community like Manchester are real. You know, when a whole entire city could get flooded by one storm, this cause and this fight became even more apparent and more important because people live there. You know, there are thousands of people that live here, and, you know, they often don't have a voice. So what we've seen is, you know, the city and others continue, you know, to ignore all of the signs, all of the warnings, and continue to encroach on our communities. And let's see, here's a picture here just to give you an idea of like how close industry is around people's homes. And this isn't the only place, you know, that it happens. Right here in Mossville, Louisiana, there's an entire community that was established by freed slaves that has been completely surrounded by industry. And Port Arthur, Texas, and Turkey Creek in Mississippi, and Africatown in Alabama, you know, on and on and on. You know, these are very historical places that folks have lived in for decades, sometimes even longer, and, you know, have established a relationship with the land there too. So that's something that's really, really hard to replace, right? So when we think about archiving and collecting stuff from people, you know, we have to remember that there's something to be said for the place as well. Like, that can never be replaced. And it's hard, you know, to translate that. I wanted to play a little bit of this testimony from Christine Bennett in Mossville. This was at a hearing, and this is also where I archive a lot of stuff. And, you know, testimonies. So just bear with me real quick. Let me get it. I just want to play a little. And this community right now, you know, is being completely taken over by a Japanese company, I believe. And they're actually partnering with the university here to collect stories for the community that they are displacing and, you know, forcibly removing from their lands. So, you know, I think that's important to think about when you're archiving and doing digital stories and collections, you know, from these communities. There should be some ethical principles that are in place. And ownership should always belong to the people who are giving them. And they should also have access to them. I just heard of another story in Virginia where there are special documents that a community is trying to obtain to show that they have been in this community for a long time. But the papers were held by, you know, slave-owning families that continue to live in the same region, and they're embarrassed. You know, they don't want that information out. But they have, you know, birth dates and names of ancestors of, you know, the slaves that they had. And that information should be, you know, given to the ancestors who are living in that same community still. You know, this is these are the sorts of things, you know, I hope you think about and you consider. And, you know, there's a couple of films and things that I can recommend. My Louisiana Love, beautiful documentary about the Houma, Vanishing Pearls, Nyala Jefferson about Point Alahash and Plaquemines Parish and the oyster fishermen who were devastated after BP. There's, you know, a lot of folks doing good work, and they also need help. You know, the documentarians, they need access to, you know, these files that, you know, are hard to obtain and find to tell the real story. I'll leave it at that, because I probably went over my time. But thank you.
Thank you, Brian. So we are going to have a Q&A. So I'm going to invite you to come up to the microphones with your questions and thoughts. While we're doing that, I'm actually going to turn the tables, shall we say. And I'm going to invite Brian and Matt, who are clearly having something going on right now, to ask each other questions first. So you can move those mics and they're more comfortable for you. If you have questions for each other, you can go ahead with that.
Ooh, I think I left my questions up there, but.
Oh, you certainly did.
I do have one. And this is for everyone too, but you know, I think it's important for people to think about what is special to them. You know, if you had to take one thing, keep one thing, you know, that is really important to you, that maybe tells your story the best, what would that be? So the flood's coming, man. What are you keeping it? And I'm not talking about, you know, deeds or insurance papers, you know.
That's a tough question. I'm not one thing. Hopefully, I think my children, first of all, I'd grab them and run. But
you don't want to put them in a library, though.
No. I'd grab a suitcase and then try to shove as much stuff into there as I possibly could. That's kind of a weak answer.
I mean, that's where we're at. Yeah, it's like, so when I hear special, it's like, well, what makes it special? I think I asked someone last night, and they're like, and they went into it. But yeah, what makes it special? There's few of them. I don't know.
It's a question we seem to ask ourselves a lot, and it shifts. I mean, you know, there are lots of people in this audience who can give very storied perspectives on that. But some of us can give new ideas as to what that means. I think that's kind of what this is all about, and it's great that you came last night and challenged people with that question, I think.
Can I ask him a quick question?
Yeah, totally.
I'm an early modern historian, so I deal with dead people all the time, and so we're talking about historical silences and archives and how to make sure that doesn't happen in the future, but how it doesn't happen in the future involves living people, and I don't have much experience with them, except, you know, on a day-to-day basis, but not an archival basis. But one of the things that Brian said that I thought was really interesting, because he does all this archival work, and this is, I guess, is a question for Brian and also for all of you, because I use your resources, but I don't create them, is you've got all this archival material. How do we make sure, like a lot of the Katrina links that I found when I was just doing my Google searches aren't there anymore? So, like, how do we make sure that your material that you're collecting remains somewhere where people in the future can get it? Because it is telling an important story, and stories that have not been told about a lot of past disasters. But I don't know, but I guess it strikes me as a real challenge, right? You've got people like you who are doing great work. What's the bridge between the work that you're doing and some kind of more formal archival setting, I guess, so that we know, you know, 100 years from now, we have those stories around somewhere?
That's a good question, and I think a lot of folks who, you know, were part of the early independent media movement would love help. I have over 100 tapes, for example, you know, little mini DV tapes of hearings, of conferences, of actions, you know, and that's all valuable information for me, because it tells the story of folks that often, you know, aren't covered, and from the perspective of those same people. So that's one thing, and I, you know, there are some digital archive universities, you know, looking to help. But again, I think for the folks who have collected it, they want to be part of the process. Like, you don't want to just dump, you know, all of the media to them. It's like, it's like handing your children over too, you know, it's like, I know these people, you know, and they're really close to me, and I want to be sure that the media is used in a responsible way, and that they also know what's happening with it as well. So that's hard, and that's why it sits, you know, in my office, and you know, I can't even remember what I have now until, you know, it just comes up for some reason, but yeah.
For now. Maybe somebody out there has an answer to this question. But we do have a question. And please identify yourself and your affiliation if you have one.
It's off.
You can take it out, Lisa. Elizabeth. One second.
Hello.
There we go.
Well, hi, Brian. It's nice seeing you here. So my name's Elizabeth Crucis. I'm from the University of Houston, and Brian is a wonderful peer activist in the community. And we need to, I've been documenting Nuestra Palabra, and we need to get together because I just, this is the first I hear about your mini discs. But so I'm from Houston, and all of this resonates so much, and it breaks my heart because Manchester is our home, right? And so my question has always been, in trying to work with you and Judith and Tejas and other non-traditional documentarians, and I see you as like an activist, archivist, an extension of that. And so my question is, how can I approach you and collaborate with you and give back to the work that you do without taking, but preserving that and bringing it into the archive and breaking the archive for you to make space for you? And so, you know, that's a question, and let's talk when we get back to Houston about those mini discs. But yeah, I think that that's a question I have grappled with being a Houstonian, and I know that there's parts all over this country where this environmental racism is occurring, and how do we go in and preserve these communities as we're also the actors of pushing them out? So that's a question and a thought. And then lastly, shameless plug, I will be at the Zine Pavilion with Zines for Tejas and Another Gulf is Possible. So I know that Brian just gave you a snippet of what we're doing in Houston, but if you want to get more facts and figures on what that work is and what that pain is, please stop by the Zine Pavilion or flag me down because it's throwing my backpack.
Awesome. Thanks. Thank you. I think, you know, starting a relationship is the first step. And I know that there's not a lot of funding already, but there should be centers, you know, because there's so much media now from the public that oftentimes is better than what the media can do because they're just not there, you know, and folks have access to it. That's why I have it with me all the time. You get it as it's happening. So we need to really think about that. And I know you can't keep everything either, right? So there has to be some definition for that special. but I think building a relationship and having long-term, you know, communication, interns maybe is a good way, and you know, just building on what those universities that exist in communities are supposedly trying to do already, right?
All right. So we're just about out of time, and we need Athena to come up here and round us all out, unless anyone else has any further questions. And we can, of course, continue our discussions.
I had one request for everyone to tweet.
Yeah.
It was one last thing. Just, yeah, like, what is that special thing? Yeah, just write it up and tweet it out, you know. Disaster's coming. What would you save? What would you like to save? And name your community.
So, Brian, are you asking people what they would tweet?
No, two tweets, yeah. What they would save. What is their special item, yeah.
Oh.
What is their special collection for the archive? And then, yeah, just use the conference hashtag, if that's okay with you.
Okay, we can continue that conversation on Twitter then.
We'd love
doing that. Hashtag RBMS18, hashtag plenary 3123, the number 3. Yeah.
I'd like to thank our moderator, Diane DeFazio, and our standing speakers for a great closing plenary. And I'm going to empathize with you because I printed this a little too small, and even with my glasses on, it's hard, so I apologize for maybe doing this.
Tough getting old. I speak only for myself, sorry.
And thank you, Ben, so much for reminding me to thank you. At work, he does this too, just so you know. I'd like to also thank you so much, Patrina, for your leadership and chairing this conference and all of your conference planning committees, everyone in this room. If you wouldn't mind, if you served on this committee or a committee that helped make this conference happen, please stand up and thank Patrina and thank everyone who worked on this right now. Please. And I would like to say, as a daughter of an American citizen who crossed the border undocumented long ago, and now as a Mexican-American woman in our field, Fort Bend County. I can't express how much looking at this crowd and experience this week's fellowship, inquiry, and knowledge sharing has meant to me. Although this officially closes the conference, in the coming days, you will be getting an email evaluation about your conference experience. Please, please, please fill it out, as your input will help design Kate and Ben's next conference and also inform Veronica Reyes Escudero as she thinks about the conference for 2020, our incoming vice chair, chair-elect. And it will help them try out new things. At the end of the survey, listen, you can enter to win a free registration to the RBMS 2019 conference in Baltimore. So now you have an incentive to fill this out. Look around. This section is healthy. Our conferences are relevant. Your presence is welcome here today and for years to come. This section has so much more to do and consider and reflect upon with regard to our legacy practices and future goals, particularly in these times. And given the topic, these past years and next years, I'm confident and proud that your RBMS will be up to the challenge while still holding strong to the fundamental commitment to preserving all of our histories. Off script for a second. I cannot tell you that this was my goal for a long time, but not just mine. If you are a person from a marginalized or oppressed community, there are a lot of people in this room who made sure that I became chair who were from the dominant culture. They wanted to see me do something, and sometimes I even shock them. I know that I say things and they're like, "Whoa." But they bear with me. They will accept you. They will accept your colleagues. They will accept your voice. You are welcome here. I promise you that. You're 100% welcome here. If you're not, call me. I'll just be in Denmark. I'll just come visit. So with that, it's my pleasure to close the 59th annual RBMS conference. And please remember to go to RBMS next year. Thank you.
Everybody, don't move. I gotta take your picture. One second.
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's not a super wide angle lens.